Oh yeah, I kind of need your help. On the podcast today, I'm going to be interviewing Dallas Taylor from podcast 20,000 Hertz that I like. And I'm just like so nervous, like I'm going to geek out, you know?
No, you need to just calm down.
I can't calm down.
No, I just always do this.
Keep thinking about it.
You always do this. No, remember when we met Edward Norton at the laundromat?
Yeah, of course.
He was doing laundry.
Yeah.
Because he says he likes how the clothes turn out more.
I know.
But you freaked out. You started going through his stuff. You can't
I was
do
helping
stuff like
him.
That.
I wanted to help him. I loved him.
You threw all the stuff down and then yelled Fight Club.
I didn't know what to do. I freaked out.
See, this is really what I'm afraid of.
You're making me more afraid.
Well, then why did you come to me?
For advice.
Okay, well, I said just calm down.
Ugh, I don't know.
Just, like, let's practice it. Like, say, okay, say I'm him, okay?
Hey, I'm Ethan. Oh, Jesus Christ.
Oh, my.
Hold on, let me try again.
Okay, hey, what's
up?
Hey,
Dallas, Dallas, Texas.
Let me say hello first.
Oh, my God, I'm fucking this up.
Stop crying.
I can't stop crying.
Stop crying.
I can't stop crying.
Yes, you can.
Bad science. Did the movie get it right? Bad science. Or will we have to fight? Bad science.
Hi everybody, welcome to Bad Science. I'm Ethan Edinburgh, and today we have a very special episode, not just because we're talking about a six-time Oscar-winning film, Mad Max Fury Road, but because we're talking with someone that I'm a huge fan of. He's the creative director of De Facto Sound and the host producer of the podcast 20,000 Hertz. It's Dallas Taylor.
Hey, thank you. Can I just hire you to go before me on every room I walk into?
Yeah, I would be honored. That's the dream job.
Sweet, you've got it.
Okay, great. I guess I quit. So that's the end of the show.
I'm now, see you later.
I'm now Dallas's intro man. Dallas, I absolutely love your podcast. So I do want to talk about that first, just because it's perfect for people like me, just audio nerds, sound geeks. It's kind of like I quickly compared it to a radio lab just because it's so tightly edited. And I don't know if I would say scripted because you do have interviews with people. But 20,000 Hertz. Everybody should listen to it. How did you get into making that podcast? How did that start?
Well, thank you for that too. I'm a sound designer myself and spent many years doing sound design, particularly for ads and trailers and TV shows and all that stuff. And even in my line of work, when we only have visuals and sound to work with, two senses to work with those two senses, sound was always kind of like totally pushed all the way into the very back burner and of this tiny little importance. So over the years I worked with a bunch of people and I was like, you know what? I want to just tell stories about sound and talk about how cool it is. And, hopefully to get people to elevate their hearing importance kind of up to the level of visual or taste or something like that. And so, so that's what I did. And, what I've found out is people are really into sound stuff. Like everyone's kind of an audiophile.
I mean, yeah, I think the podcast medium is perfect for it. And I think you just absolutely nail it. All these stories are so interesting and you do such a great way of like weaving in these audio examples. And it kind of leads us perfectly into this film because it seems they out of the six Oscars it won, two of them were for sound. I think it won best mixing and sound editing. And it's something that I think a lot of people don't think about when they're watching a movie, which maybe is a good thing because it should be, you know, kind of like the base in a band. I would think about it like you're not actively thinking about that when you're listening to a song, but if the bass is good you can just feel it in your soul. And that's certainly the case with this film. So why do you think it did win both of those awards, and did it stick out to you in that way, like while you were watching the film, were you thinking like, wow, the sound in this is incredible?
Oh yeah. So I mean, this is kind of like when sound is not restricted at all in a film or with a budget constraint or anything, if you get something like this. I believe there's like, I counted on IMDb 79 credits just for sound on this film.
Okay.
And that's just super rare, even in a giant film. And so when you just have like so much attention brought to it and so much like so many people who can think about it and experiment and time and all this stuff, like you get something like what we got here. You just can't just like land on cool sounds and throw them in. It really takes like a lot of experimentation, a lot of trial and error, and a lot of different people with different backgrounds and things to kind of put something like this together. And it's just like 2 hours of just like a masterclass is kind of cliche to say, but like it's like 2 hours of like nonstop sound perfection. Mm-hmm. I mean, it could be arguably kind of the sound editing / sound mixing film of the decade.
Yeah.
Just with how much thought and time and like craftsmanship went into that.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. It's funny because I was watching it a second time thinking about the sound because I knew I'd be talking to you, and there was a few parts where I was like, oh, that was kind of out of place, or that was kind of lame, because like, you know, for example, he like snaps his fingers at one point and it's clearly not a snap that you would hear in a car. Yeah. Outside. It's like a beautiful, like perfect snap in like a gorgeous reverb. And then it was dawning on me that like, oh, that's completely on purpose. Like they want us to hear particular things at particular times in order to tell a story or like part of a story, right?
Yeah, there's nothing in this that actually is like scientifically factual with the way that that sound physics works. And that's what people want, though. You know, yeah. It's like you don't want a cartoon that's like, you know what, we're a cartoon, so we're not gonna have any sound because we're not real. Like you gotta make it, you know, something cool. And this is kind of like a cartoonish version of just like cinematography and storytelling brilliance, I guess. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to say like what it is. It's weird because it has so little dialogue.
Right.
And it's just like shot. It's like a constant chase for 2 hours of, it makes me feel like, I mean, I've never done methamphetamines. I don't know if you have.
I have not.
But I have not. And I suspect that if I did, this is about what it would be like.
Right.
For 2 hours. Like I watched it for the second time, in a long time last night, and finished it at like midnight. And I was like, I can't go to sleep. Like, I just want to go
run.
I want to go do like 10,000 pushups right now. And considering I can barely do 20, I think I could have done it though. But yeah, it's just like a nonstop white knuckle thrill ride.
Yeah.
That just doesn't let up. I mean, it kind of lets up, but it's still just like this constant moving of things. And as a sound designer, so I do a lot of sound designer for, I do a lot of sound design for trailers and advertising, and do a lot of these like really intense car spots. So things that would share similar types of sound design here. But I mean, even in our world, 30 seconds of something like this would take, oh my goodness, a week plus weeks of back and forth with clients and stuff, just because there's so many directions you can go.
Right.
And that's kind of like the brilliance of it, is that every second of this thing could have been designed in a completely different way and it still would have been amazing. But they chose this, and somehow, even through the bureaucracy of making a film, landed on something eventually and put it out. So it's like the perfect example of like an achievement in sound. I think it's important to remember like Oscars are about achievements and things like that, and like best is relative and all that stuff, but like to achieve something to this level, I think they did 75 days of just a final mix, so this is after they've done all the sound editing and all that stuff. So it's just like it's a marvel from like the first few minutes of on just any kind of sound front.
Yeah, yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. Not that anybody cares about my thoughts on that, but...
I do.
Oh, I appreciate that. I really feel like this was the perfect live-action cartoon movie. Like, there's nothing else I've seen that
very much for adults, yeah.
Right, exactly. It's for adults, and there's tons of action, and there's things flipping around and exploding and crashing all over the place, but it all feels real and cartoonish at the same time, which, like, I don't know if I've ever seen before, at least not to this extent.
It seems like George Miller, the director on it, took, like, 20 years to just, like, wouldn't it be cool if we... and insert any possibility of cool. And it's just like, it's like a montage of just like the most baller thing you could possibly put on screen just over and over and over and over and over again.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, with the sound stuff, it's like, you know, things, interestingly, there's different styles around the world. There's like a very American style of like sound design and mixing and things. And then there's kind of a something that I've seen in like a British style. It's a lot more like true to reality generally. Of course, you know, when we're talking about superhero movies and stuff, things change.
Right.
But this one is like such like in the pocket of like what style of sound design is really popular right now. And it's just like ultra tight, ultra clean, ultra quiet. Even the voiceover, like right at the top, is like unbelievably not real because it sounds like it's coming out of like Tom Hardy's throat. Like it's probably like a shotgun that's like picking up the back of his throat. It's just super intimate and I love it.
Yeah.
But you know, there's of course cliches and there's all those things and that's important to
I just love not when I don't feel barraged by sound in an action movie. I feel like most of the time watching these action movies, it's just I'm being hit in the face constantly. And you're right. There were these moments of just absolute silence or just, you know, really quiet when he's like walking up to a car and you just hear the gun cock or something. And the tightness of it was extremely attractive. It was so pleasant to listen to the entire movie. And you wouldn't think that going in. You know, you would watch the trailer. I mean, all trailers sound like bombs are just going off constantly now. Can be a family drama about a rich British family and somehow it's just bomb every 5 seconds.
But base dives and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. But this, I don't know, even in between the action, it just seemed so, so nice. It was like an orchestra of sound, which was, incredibly impressive.
What's mature about this film on the sound front as far as, especially this is very much speaking to the mix level. Now there's two different things here. Like I think that most people kind of don't know what the difference between like achievement and sound editing versus achievement and sound mixing, but sound editing has to do with like the creation and the building of all of the elements that will then later be kind of mixed. So the mixer is like a conductor of an orchestra. The sound editing is like the performers. You know, they're providing the feedback to where the conductor can kind of craft and all that stuff. And what's really mature about this is like the constant barrage is a cliche unto itself, and we see that all the time in trailers. Yeah. But when you look at, like, when you're working on a film, like, there's this constant idea that, like, every single scene has to be the most epic thing in the entire world, like, constant epicness over and over and over again. Well, if you have constant epicness all the time, you don't have any frame of reference of what's not epic to make it epic. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, can anything that's super epic can almost just look kind of cheesy and cliche and de-elevate a little bit.
Right.
But what I mean in this context is like, if you don't have quiet, you can't have loud because we are in control of the remote controls. And if you always have loud, you just turn it down and it's all just ho-hum.
Yep.
So in this one, what's great is they kind of force you on this whole roller coaster of super quiet, super big and boomy, and then kind of everything in between.
You're saying that editing includes sound design, Foley, like the creation of sound.
Yeah, so I can give you kind of the general idea of what the soundtrack looks like. So we all know dialogue and kind of voiceover and all the voice elements, and then we have music, and a lot of people know that. Mm-hmm. Now, even within those, the music aspect, when the music mixer on a film could have hundreds of tracks of every single instrument to where they can just pull down the violins when someone's talking rather than the entire score. So there's a lot of nuance involved with just the music mix. But the sound design is kind of split up among a handful of different categories. So you have Foley. These are things that like you touch with your hands and feet generally. So like walking would be recreated completely. This is usually done in like a studio with two performers with mics really close to their feet or hands. And then somebody kind of recording it all.
Are you a master Foley performer at this
point?
Am
I a master Foley? No.
Oh, okay.
I do a lot more commercials. So most of my Foley is like 3 footsteps in a sequence of a montage type of thing. Mm-hmm. So Foley, Foley's in a performance, like, and that's an extension of the actor already. Like bad Foley can be really funny just unto itself.
Yes. I love comical. That, by the way.
Yeah. So then you have like another level, backgrounds. So these are things that kind of tie scenes together. This is wind. This is birds. It's things that like, as they cut the camera, because keep in mind, a lot of these are single camera. Most films are, or a lot of films are single camera. So they're cutting different parts of the day and completely different times just to shoot different actors, you know, talking to each other. Mm-hmm. So backgrounds is this thing that kind of like tie everything together. it, you know, combined with the Foley, you kind of have an environment, you have a, you know, you have the things that the actor's touching and all that. You have this thing called heart effects, which is kind of everything else. So like if you make an explosion, you typically you're going to go out and record explosions and then kind of combine explosions to get like every element of an explosion kind of like perfect, from the attack, the sustain, the release, you know, a door slam, like anything that you're kind of pull from a recorded sound library is generally going to be this heart effects. And then something that I think about a lot, just because it's come up so much in nowadays in trailers and stuff, is this whole world of like emotional effects. These are like cymbal whines and like boom hits and like things that are like purely designed to elicit an emotional response, a bass dive, things like that. So those are generally kind of what people think of. Now, in a giant film like this, there's going to be whole sets of tracks to, dedicated to one single vehicle, or like, you know, the whole kind of clan over here and over there and all that stuff. So it can get extraordinarily complicated. And I know with this film in particular, the sound was unreal. I mean, they had, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of sounds probably. And a big part of this was, with out of all of those sounds, is like finding focus on single or a handful of sounds that would really kind of like, speak to the scene the best, and then have the other thousand just kind of underneath it in a subtle way. So it's just wild to get to this level of sound design.
Yeah, that sounds like a maze of hell. Do you think that they were recording on the day all of these? Because, you know, I saw some behind the scenes footage, which if you enjoy Mad Max Fury Road, you need to go online and watch these little mini docs on how they made the movie, because it's absolutely wild. These like stuntmen, I mean, we could do a whole podcast about how badass the stuntmen are in this movie. They're just doing wild stuff. And by the way, I wanted to mention a fun fact that two pairs of stuntmen met and fell in love and got married on the set of Mad Max Fury Road. So I thought that was adorable.
Not only that, it was Tom Hardy's stunt double and Charlize Theron's stunt double that
yes.
came together and got married.
That's correct. They have the best story of all time now.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, they're actually blowing stuff up, right? They're actually making
yeah.
like these huge explosions, these timed explosions, and they're actually crashing all these cars. So do you think that they were also, you know, miking all of this stuff and using it for the mix later, or did they just do everything, you know, over again in some sort of soundstage?
They were doing a combination of both, but I know on this film, when they were doing car stuff, they had a second unit of sound that was going and recording the cars and kind of additional sound effects there on site, which is unheard of. Like, no one does that. So they had like a second unit of sound people that like went off with the cars when they weren't shooting them and recording them. And I'm sure that same unit was probably recording the explosions and everything too. So, but you know, of course, in sound we have 800 billion explosion sounds. So whether or not they use those, who knows?
Yeah.
They probably try.
I mean, it does seem like a good move, though, like not to waste all this, you know, all these engines and stuff. Like, that's,
yeah.
I would want it recorded too.
Well, sometimes you just don't know what the mechanics are. And sometimes, like, what you see and what you want to hear are two totally different things. Like, even with a gunshot or something, like what a real gunshot sounds like is like a crack. Like, it's just like a pop. Like mm-hmm. firework, but you don't want to hear that. Like, you want to hear, like, you know, when I'm designing something like that, like, you know, I could grab the sound of a crack, but it's so unsatisfying. So it's like, I have to put like that sound plus like, some sort of, you know, other shotgun or like some sort of explosion underneath that with a addition, like add like a thump on the microphone, add a cannon, you know, add like the biggest possible things possible to where like you can, you know, give the feeling of what you want to hear, not what you actually hear.
So the sound of guns in the movies, for the most part, is a lot scarier than the real sound of a gun.
Oh, yeah. No, real guns are just loud and sound like a firecracker. Explosions don't have... even explosions, like you just don't have like that level of detail in anything. But with films and stuff, like we have the ability, and we've even been taught what things sound like through films. That just is not accurate at all. You know, even like sound in space and stuff. Like,
right, right.
Sometimes it works really well. I remember like from the first reboot of Star Trek, like the Chris Pine version of it and stuff. There's this great scene where like the hull gets breached and there's all this chaos and super loud stuff. And then you follow this one character gets sucked out of the hull and then it just goes into silence. And it's like, okay, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
But generally, if you have a space fight and you see explosions, like it, I don't know, it'd be kind of boring to not hear it, depending on what the artistic intent is. But there's a lot of stuff we've kind of been trained on with sound through films that are just not accurate at all in the real world.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Hey everyone, this is Jesse David Fox, host of Good One, a podcast about jokes. I am proud to announce that I have personally won the Streaming Wars. And there's a new docu-special on Peacock based on our own Vulture podcast. Good One, a show about jokes, follows Mike Birbiglia as he develops new material, taking audiences through the process of transforming personal stories into stand-up. Featuring interviews with Mike's family and comedy colleagues like Seth Meyers, Hasan Minhaj, and Asko Akatsuka, Good One, a show about jokes, is streaming now only on Peacock.
The break is over. Here we go, back to the show about science.
Okay, so I, again, a few things that confuse me. Number one, towards the beginning of the film, they dump a bunch of water through these, like, three pipes, and it just seems like the most ineffective way to give people some water, right?
I think you're right, yeah. So I guess that they have they sum all this stuff up in like a minute, like right at the beginning with like some voiceover and news stuff. And apparently, I guess there's like an oil war, and then they extend that all the way to water war. So yeah, you have all this water somewhere buried deep in a mountain, with a right. pretty great infrastructure where everything else around is pretty awful infrastructure. But I don't know, they built something out pretty amazingly this into a mountain with a great connection and with a great release valve.
Yep.
But they're just kind of like, once it's out in the open, we're just gonna see what happens to it and just rain it down on people.
Yeah, it was the first example of a few times in the movie where it seems like, oh, you have this ability but no other abilities to do anything. It's like, yeah, you have such primitive technology, but then you have a guitar with a bunch of amps, you know?
Yeah, which is pretty awesome.
I mean, super awesome. And I totally get why they did it, because it's awesome and like cartoonish and comic booky, but it just made other stuff stand out where you're like, why can't you give people water in bowls? Why can't you just pour it out in small increments? Everyone's thirsty.
Yeah. I always wonder, like, did the guitar player and stuff, like, was there somebody who like trained the guitar player? Like, did he go through music school or like,
right.
I mean, he's pretty decent.
Yeah.
I mean, even like the distortion pedals and stuff, we're like, where do they get that, like out in the middle of nowhere?
It's yeah,
like,
they have really distortion pedals but like no radio.
Yeah, and it's like the speaker cabinet array and stuff is like just so perfectly manufactured, but like but yeah, it's just a, you know,
and poor guy doesn't have anybody to jam with.
Exactly. There's, and there's no one else. They did have taiko drums everywhere, though. Even children were banging on taiko drums, which is a very convenient drum to have when you are doing epic things all the time.
Right.
You know, I'm just glad they didn't have like bongos, because this whole film would have been a lot different.
Yeah. It would have been, very strangely like a samba, which I would have loved. But, you know, I also would have loved like a bass player maybe give that guy a mic. Maybe
I would like to see this whole film with a bossa nova soundtrack, though. That'd be,
I mean,
sweet.
Listen, I don't know what you're doing if you have any projects lined up, but I feel like we could get a lot of press if we remixed all of Mad Max Fury Road with samba.
It would be the smart thing to do.
Okay, well, great. Yeah. So that's what I'll be doing the next month or two. nobody eats in this movie. I was thinking about that.
Wow.
Like, I mean, they barely drink. I mean, the water is certainly not enough. Everybody needs to drink more water, and we have water. But nobody's drinking any water. And then also, he eats like a lizard towards the beginning of the movie. And then
the one guy eats a bug.
Right. He eats this tiny, like a little spider type beetle.
The milkmaids, though, apparently eat a lot because they were clearly fed.
Sure. Yep. Yeah. That's true. And yeah, I mean, there's bigger guys. I mean, like a lot of these, I don't know what they're called because nobody says anything in this movie, but the soldiers or whatever are all like jacked up. You know, these guys are like super strong.
This might be actually pretty accurate because generally when you accumulate wealth and stuff, of course, you're going to be the top of the food chain. So there's almost like a bit of like if you're really big and chunky, like you might do really well for yourself. You know, I could definitely lose a few, but I really enjoy eating. So it's kind of like a back and forth with that. But with this, like all the leaders were the ones that like were the fattest, which made the most sense that they kind of accumulated most of that stuff.
Right.
While all the soldiers and stuff were like famine and barely eating anything.
Yeah, but they're also jacked up. Like the people that were waiting for the water down there, like the population are, they seem to be starving.
So they have like a secret stash of protein bars somewhere.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, like that's really what it seemed like.
Yeah. And like weight rooms and stuff somewhere.
There's a giant gym in that mountain somewhere and some sort of hunting range, I guess, where there's like buffalo and deer and stuff. I would have appreciated seeing some sort of, you know, like a bunch of carcasses or something somewhere.
See, like a spa scene where they're just like getting jacked and like sitting in the steam room, like ready to go.
Yeah, doing sit-ups.
Why was their skin white? Was that paint
or
was that like their, okay.
I mean, I guess it's paint because they also have that like chrome spray for when they're going to kill themselves.
Apparently that's like a euphoria thing. Like it's a thing that apparently has like a euphoria drug in it. So they like spray their face right before they like martyr themselves and they like spray their teeth and all this stuff. And they have like a chrome god. I know they do worship like the V8. I know that's a big part of the movie, but yeah, they kind of sacrifice
themselves. They worship
themselves.
A giant juice company?
Oh yeah, or the juice company. Yeah, I mean, who knows? Tomato juice and salt.
I mean, you got to get a sponsor however you can these days.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's there are some jacked folks in here. Their scars seem pretty conveniently epic for a big moment like this.
I mean, they had some milk, I guess. I don't know. That just confused me throughout the whole film.
Such an uncomfortable
part. Jacked
up.
I feel like you got to eat so much to get that juiced.
They did make a point to show that one of the guys who was super jacked up was drinking the milk. I don't know.
Right. Yeah. His son or whatever. Right.
That is a protein source.
Yeah.
An uncomfortable one.
Yeah, but it's something.
Something.
Everybody else has literally dirt to eat.
Yeah.
Dust. He, at the beginning, attaches Max to his car, to the front of his car, and he calls him a blood bag. And he, I guess, is like, it's like a transfusion. He, like, needs his blood for some reason, but I didn't, it just seemed like, hey, let's go. I'm taking this guy. I'm taking his blood. Let's go. And I just didn't understand why he needed his blood.
You know, I'm glad that this podcast is not about factual, like the part of the actual story, because I know this is documented somewhere, but I'm glad that I can just wing it and kind of go, this is what I think. Like I think that all their like cracked lips was because of the water situation. And then the blood thing, I'm not exactly sure, but I know that right at the beginning of the film they tattoo that he was O positive, so he was a universal donor, and so he was like really valuable, and then they hung him up upside down to like drain his blood into this really thin guy who ends up kind of joining the gang later. Why that was the case? Well, maybe it has something to do with white skin. I don't know.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. I know that I know that this is probably as easy as a Google search, but you know, why would we do that?
I don't know.
When we could
certainly
just
don't have time.
Yeah, no.
I could have easily done that. Okay. He shoots gas. He shoots fire out of his guitar. Speaking of the guitar guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, like, the whole war here, the whole battle is for oil and for gas, right? And so why the fuck would he just be shooting? There's, like, several dudes who are just flamethrowing from the back of cars, and it's seemingly for no reason at all, right?
It does seem like these people are relatively uneducated don't see the correlation between fighting for more of the stuff and wasting it while they're, maybe it's just an example. I don't know. Maybe it's just a analogy for the human condition.
Okay. Here we go. Now that's a solid answer.
Like a smart thing. I don't think that really holds any weight at all. It just sounded like something that would be smart to say in the moment.
No, that is smart. I feel like it's true. We as a people just waste stuff for no, just 'cause we like it. just because it's fun. And in the meanwhile, like, we have a finite amount of resources.
That's true. Yeah. And so we're just flame throwing out of our guitars in all kinds of little small ways in life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Stop flame throwing however you're flame throwing, guys.
It seems like that would be like an inspirational quote in that, like that really inspirational cursive with like flowers in the background. Like,
yeah, there's a cat hanging on from a cliff.
Yeah.
And he's holding a flamethrower. Stop.
I think of like footprints in the sand, except for like there's like a charred part like of on the side of the screen or something.
I'm telling you, if there were more charred cats on posters, people would pay attention, right?
That's true. Yeah. If you want people to pay attention, just you know, do something terrible with cats, I guess.
Yeah.
Oof. I mean,
you said it, not me, but I'm agreeing with you.
I'm just gonna scoot away right now.
Yeah. Okay. I wanted to ask you, going back to sound, what other films, like, I don't know, impress you in the same way? Because I was trying to just think about, and I couldn't. What movies, like, I just highlighted.
Oh, there's got to be so many. The things that I love are something like WALL-E, that where everything is created from scratch, and it's just so well thought out of, it's so well thought out. And the thing that is difficult is not just throwing sounds at something. It's like it's like finding the right sound for something, and finding the character alongside that. So like WALL-E was really impressive, and it was even beyond just the WALL-E voice, which was brilliant, and Eve's voice, but it was like the mechanics of the size of WALL-E. It was like the rockets, and like everything was just like so perfect. In that, there's a lot of I love sci-fi in general just because it's so adventurous. But there's a lot of room for cliche in that too. Yeah, Pixar stuff's great. Is the Star Trek stuff? Yeah, any space stuff, the Star Wars stuff. They're just all so brilliant. Mm-hmm. But there's opportunities to be great in everything. It really just depends on like how much the director and the team cares. I think that there's a little bit of like a race to how cheaply can you produce something in all content in general.
Yeah.
And sound is just not on the priority list when you're going through a sheet of budgets and stuff. And this is kind of just the opposite. I think with anything, if you put more time into sound, it's just going to be so much better. In quality and everything.
When it's overlooked, or like you said, not spent enough time on, it's so obvious to me, and it just takes me out of whatever I'm watching so quickly.
Yeah.
I was watching an interview with one of the guys that did sound, and he was mentioning diegetic sounds for the film. Do you know what that is? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I believe diegetic is the things that you actually see. It's like the source from what's coming out of the film. So like if a diegetic sound is like if someone, you know, rattles a door handle or something, like that's a thing that's coming from the world. Okay. I don't know what the opposite of that is, but yeah, it's kind of like that emotional versus like real from the world sound. It's like a real complicated way. I've never liked the word diegetic because it's like a thing that no one understands and you have to like look it up.
Right.
But it's like, I think it's just as easy to be like sounds of the world. Like, you know, these are the sounds that are in the world versus the big bass dive that you just heard, which is out of the world. And
got
more
it.
Emotional. Yeah. It's like music would not be diegetic unless the guitar player like that would be in the world.
Speaking of the guitar player, he had a bunch of amps that were facing him. My question there is like, and this, I also have the same question for gunshots and explosions and stuff like that. If you're close to such a loud sound, would that deafen you?
He definitely, so the guitar player for sure has some high-end loss on his hearing. We all have high-end loss, depending on how old you are. You slowly kind of lose the very top end. Generally, we can hear from 20 to 20,000 hertz. 20 hertz is like 20 vibrations in the air, which is really low-pitched. Mm-hmm. It's like if you take your hand, speaker cone, if you think of a speaker cone, do that in and out 20 times, that's 20 hertz. You do that 20,000 times and it just gets higher in pitch. But we as humans, like our ears slowly kind of creep down to 16K, 15K, 12K. And this is just natural. It's just going to happen.
Can't wait.
Yeah, exactly. It's amazing. But that of course can be escalated very quickly. If you put a giant, you know, rack of amps behind you, a rack of like speakers and stuff, especially with like just that screechy noise, he's definitely losing a lot of that. I'd be surprised if he can really hear over 8K. I think that there's probably a lot of mumbling sounds in there. He could already have hearing aids. You never know with what technology they have there. We did see the like ultrasound thing, not the ultrasound, but like the guy put the little like primitive hearing thing on the belly. Yeah,
little doctor move.
Before all the terribleness stuff happened. But no, it was cringy for me to see like, I don't know, like an AK-47 or something similar, like put on Tom Hardy's shoulder and then shot like an inch away from his ear. No, I think that would completely blow your eardrum.
Like, okay, I instantly thought about that. I was like, how, he's just sitting there like, yeah, go ahead.
Well, it's like a pressure wave. Like, sound operates very much like a pressure wave, and that's just an enormous explosion of pressure. I mean, that's why explosions sound like explosions. It's because it's a pressure wave, and that's when you see those videos of like a giant like bomb going off, and then you see the sound, you see the wave coming at you, you know, like you see that like shock wave coming.
Yeah.
Well, that's also like sound, and I think it is at the speed of sound or something similar, depending on your altitude and temperature and barometric pressure and all that stuff. But if you imagine putting that pressure right next to the ear with all of those really sensitive tiny little bones and membranes and stuff, it would be like hitting a snare drum with a bullet, you know. So it's gonna break.
Right.
So he can definitely not hear out of his right ear. They did underplay that, I think, with tinnitus sound. So both times that it was really close up, you heard tinnitus. That's that real high-pitched ringing sound, which is something that a lot of people have tinnitus all the time, but your brain will filter it out. Can have like an explosion happen, and then like everything goes really quiet with some sort of tinnitus, but it's definitely ramped up in this. If they should have just cut all sound from the right side of the theater altogether for the rest of the film, just to be accurate.
Yeah, that would have been great.
Yeah.
Very realistic. Too realistic, I would say. I have a couple of fun facts here. Not sure if you know, not sure if you don't. George Miller, do you know that, you know, he directed all these Mad Max movies, which are like classically violent, but he also directed some kids movies. You know about this?
That's true. Like Babe, I think.
And, yes, he directed Babe, Pig in the City, and he directed both Happy Feet movies, Happy Feet and Happy Feet 2.
Another fun fact, I wonder if you have it here. Do you know who edited the film?
His wife.
His wife.
Yes.
Why was that? And she said, because if a guy edited it, it would look like every other action movie.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that totally makes sense. The editing was awesome. I think that also won an Oscar, right?
It did.
This movie just cleaned house. especially for like not being a typical movie.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's what's so unique. It's just such a unique thing. Like, I would say everyone has to watch it once and enjoy that first, like, oh my goodness, like constant barrage. I'd say like, don't watch it before you're trying to go to sleep. Enjoy it. I mean, I'm a big fan of even just headphone listening and stuff. Like I'm not an audiophile to the point where it's like, you can only do this in 5.1, this and this, da, da, da. Like I watch a lot of films just like on my Bose headphones with my laptop on my stomach. And I watch this and I could still experience just that epic, beautiful stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, what other fun facts do you have here?
I have, so there's a line where someone says, he's a crazy smeg who eats Schlanger.
There's no cursing in this film, right?
Correct. Yeah. They use smeg because it was used in the television series Red Dwarf from 1988, because that was used like as an alternative for expletives. And then Schlanger is an Aussie slang word for penis.
Yeah, some of the visuals are very disturbing. You know, the guy with the fake nose and his piercings.
Yes.
Very prominent on his chest for some reason. I don't know if that's like a thing that, I mean, if I just walked in like that, I feel like you'd be intimidated, especially if you didn't know me.
I mean, I wouldn't want to fight you.
Yeah, that's right. I don't know if we'd continue the conversation. I think we would. I think you'd just be, you'd go with it.
I mean, well, I'm contractually your intro guy, so I probably wouldn't have a choice.
That's true, yeah.
I thought, this is not a fun fact, just something I wrote down, but I thought that Max or Tom Hardy sounded a lot like Bane.
I agree.
A few times.
Yeah. He also complained, you know, he was really hard to work with because he didn't know what they were shooting. And I think that another thing that he said is like, he just didn't know what the direction was supposed to be. George Miller was coordinating such a massive operation that so many different pieces came together to tell that story that I can imagine the actors themselves being like, I have no idea what I'm doing or what I'm supposed to be going toward or what, like, I mean, if you read a script, it's under 4,000 words of dialogue, which is crazy. He has 52 lines of dialogue in the entire 2-hour movie about that's called Mad Max, and he's Max and he has 52 lines of dialogue, and that's including just like 2-word lines.
Right.
So it's a lot of, it's just like, just, you know, hey, we want to hire you just to like look like Tom Hardy and just do like a Tom Hardy look there.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, he did a bunch of great Tom Hardy looks.
He
definitely looks a lot like Tom Hardy.
He did. And he did a great, great job of being Tom Hardy. But yes, he did sound like Bane.
There was just a few that stuck out to me. I was like, man, that is right on the nose.
And he had like the mask for a good portion of the film.
Yes,
right at the beginning.
Also true. That did not help.
Yeah, not at all.
So as we're wrapping up here, I figured we'd end with the ending of the film because it confused me, which is very easy to do. There's a quote at the end that says, "Where must we go? We who wander this wasteland in search of our better selves." And then it shows who said the quote or where the quote's from. And it says, "The first history man." So is that a big joke?
I have no idea. That was another thing, again, Google, but I thought it was like personally, I was just like, we don't need a quote after all this stuff. We're good. The quote was kind of like, what are we trying to say here? Like, is it the, like, we need to make a difference? Like, we are the world. Like,
right.
Is this an inspirational quote? The first man thing, I don't know. I'm sure it's very profound. I just refuse to type that into Google. Felt, for whatever it was, it felt real preachy to me. I was like, I enjoyed the film, but I don't think I need more confirmation on whatever it is that's need to be said here.
Okay, hold on a second, dude. I'm looking this up right now. I'm Googling it on my phone.
See, the problem is now you're going to Google it, and it's going to be something very profound and important to the world, and I'm just going to look like a jerk.
I might be wrong here, but what I'm reading is the opposite. It seems like this is a fictional book that exists within the Mad Max universe.
That's
it's
just
quoting itself.
That's just pretend. You can't. I mean, I guess, you know, everything's made up, but like, it's a next level to be like, you know, I made this whole story up, but now I'm going to make up a quote from the story in a book that is even. What does it mean?
Man.
Does it even say what it means?
No, it just says. Oh, man. It says the history men are the people who are telling the story that Max is involved in. This guy thinks they're mentioned at the end of Road Warrior.
Okay. It's kind of like the theory that Samuel Tarly wrote the Game of Thrones books.
Yeah, but could you imagine if after like a big episode they quoted Samuel Tarly and be like, what the hell is this?
I mean, it still would have been a better ending to be like,
hey, good call.
You know, the end, Samuel Tarly. I'd have been like, okay, finally, that's something cool, I guess.
The quote they use is him saying the end.
The end. Samuel
doesn't
Tarly.
Inspire shit.
That would have been something. But in this case, you know, it must have just been like a throwback. I will admit I did not see the other two. I was very, very, very young.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, but I guess there's no point in doing
it.
I
was alive. I think the first one was like 1985 or 2 or somewhere around there. But
yeah.
My parents were semi-responsible and did not take a 2-year-old to go see Mad Max, which I would also suggest does not happen with this film.
Yeah, it would be a lot for a 2-year-old. Perfect.
So, yeah, it's kind of getting there. It's like you got to grow up at some point.
Yeah, yeah, and that point is 3.
That point is 3.
Okay, so everyone should obviously listen to 20,000 Hertz and contact Defecto Sound for their HBO trailers. everyone that works at HBO, is there something else people should know about?
No, the big thing is podcast. It's all about sound. A lot of times we're taking like a really famous sound, in particular when you're thinking about movies. Like we did this whole series on the Wilhelm Scream, the Booge, a little comical look at like that sound that hasn't really been defined all that much. We did a whole story about movie soundtracks, and all of them are really, every episode takes us about 150 to 200 hours to make.
Holy
crap.
We're
really particular about it. So it is scripted on a voice, on a narration front, like from me. But we have some really fascinating people. There's a lot of, really great relevant content if you're into movies and all that stuff. But then there's also a lot of psychology and stuff. But the big thing is we're just trying to make sound accessible and not be a gatekeeper and crazy audiophiles or, I don't know. Audio in general has been this thing that's like, the angry ponytail guy only has a you know, an opinion on this and you're not allowed, but this is very much for like everyone. So go immediately. 20,000 hertz, all spelled out. There's no numbers in that. So TWE, etc., blah, blah, blah. Subscribe. Then just forget about it until it pops back up. Or go listen to an old episode. That's fine, too.
It's a fantastic podcast, Dallas. Was just listening to that 808 one today. You had DJ Jazzy Jeff talking about 808s.
Yes, that was
and it's
epic.
Yeah, it's just phenomenal. So I hope everybody does check it out. And thank you so much for joining me on the pod. And I hope that at some point we can do this face-to-face.
Definitely. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bad Science is hosted and produced by me, Ethan Edinburgh. The associate producer is Emily Feld. Our engineer and editor is Lucas Bollinger.
And the executive pro-decibel-ducer is Brett Kushner.
Follow us on Instagram at Bad Science Show. That's at Bad Science Show for behind-the-scenes photos and more. Send us an email at badscience@seeker.com. That's badscience@seeker.com. Let us know what movie you'd like to hear next and any thoughts you have on the show. And, of course, leave us an iTunes review. That lets other people hear about the show, which we all really appreciate. Alrighty, I will see you next week. Bye-bye.